The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thank you for taking the time to be with me on this late Sunday afternoon. We're going to begin with a topic that I know many of you are concerned about. That's artificial intelligence. Where is it going, and what will it mean for humanity? And you're going to hear from one of the most thoughtful people on this topic. She is Rooman Chaudhry, the global lead for responsible AI at Accenture, who says we think about AI differently than we do other technologies.
When we talk about artificial intelligence, we don't use the same words that we use when we talk about other technologies. So you'll see articles like, this was a racist AI or a sexist algorithm. And it's very interesting because you would never refer to your car that way or your toaster that way. It'd be rather ridiculous. But we've taken this thing, artificial intelligence, which is literally, I can promise you, it's code, it's programming, it's built by a human being. And we've humanized, we've anthropomorphized it.
Yeah.
And then when something goes wrong, we shift the blame from the human that's created it, and we put that blame on the algorithm.
And then I will be joined by Rafael Alvarez, the founder and CEO of GenesisWorks. They provide pathways to career success for high school students in underserved communities. And he tells us what kind of students they're looking for.
So we start recruiting juniors in high school, and our sweet spot is what we call the quiet middle. That middle-of-the-pack kid in large urban schools serving an underprivileged population. But we're not going after the super performer young man or woman or the troublemaker either. It's that middle-of-the-pack kid who normally is pretty quiet, has it in them to succeed. They just don't have the opportunity.
But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, July 29th. The Alzheimer's Association has announced that its Step Up the Pace campaign has raised $109 million since 2014 in support of efforts to accelerate the pace of research on Alzheimer's disease. Girls-only shop classes are gaining traction, and the timing is right. A shortage of skilled workers is driving up wages in male-dominated trades such as auto repair, construction, and welding. And educators say these classes offer more than just job prospects. They're also a source of empowerment. Environmentalists are expressing concern over Amazon Prime. Expedited shipping means your packages may not be as consolidated as they could be, leading to more cars and trucks required to deliver them and an increase in packaging waste. Researchers have found this is adding more congestion to our cities, pollutants to our air, and cardboard to our landfills. 7 in 10 fundraisers didn't see their pay rise enough in 2017 to keep pace with inflation. The Charles Koch Foundation plans to make copies of its future university grants deals and put them online. The Conservative Philanthropy's grant-making has come under increased scrutiny since a recent disclosure of some of its older gift arrangements at George Mason University. Those donations gave the foundation the potential leeway to influence faculty hiring. And, according to a 2017 American College President survey, women comprised only 30% of college presidents across the country. Women of color? A mere 5%. Warren Buffett, for years, has been giving away some of his considerable wealth to the foundation run by his pals, Bill and Melinda Gates. As a result, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, along with Gates himself, now owns more than 5% of Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway. Lin-Manuel Miranda has helped create a multimillion-dollar fund to boost the arts in Puerto Rico as it struggles to recover from Hurricane Maria. And finally, just smelling a coffee-like scent, which has no caffeine in it, creates an expectation for students that they will perform better on tests. And they actually do perform better, according to the research at the Stevens Institute of Technology. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Rooman Chaudhry of Accenture right after this.
I just finished months of chemo, but I don't want to talk about months. I want to talk about years. Treatments have gotten better, so I'm hoping for good years ahead. That's thanks to research funded by the American Cancer Society. The same folks giving me free rides to treatments, insurance advice, and a place to stay during chemo. I need that stuff like you don't know. And now that you do, please give at cancer.org.
Well, my husband is a retired sergeant from the Air Force.
Well, he was in the Army for 14 years and an MP.
23 million veterans, they're heroes who need our help.
Well, I'm here because my daughter has had her third surgery for cancer.
We've had some difficulties, so we're here quite some time. We're going on to 3 weeks.
When our heroes' families need help, they turn to Fisher House.
We learned about the Fisher House through the doctor, and we were so grateful because who has 3 weeks to be able to come and stay at a hotel?
Fisher House is a safe, free place to stay for families of wounded warriors and veterans receiving treatment at VA and military medical centers.
Fisher House is not only a home away from home, it was like family away from family.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Thank you, Fisher House.
Helping military and veterans' families. Fisher House at fisherhouse.org. Sometimes having family close by is a hero's best medicine.
Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Can you help me remember how to smile?
Artificial intelligence is becoming more prevalent across the world and in our individual lives every day. There are those who believe AI and robotics will take away our jobs and our purpose and maybe even destroy humanity altogether. Others are excited and believe it will usher in a golden age the likes we have never seen. But my next guest maintains that neither scenario is preordained, but depends upon what we, human beings, decide what we're going to do with it. She is Ruman Chaudhary, the global lead for responsible AI at Accenture. Good evening, Ruman, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Thank you for having me.
You know, there's so much to talk with you about. I hope we don't mind if we jump around a little bit, but I'd like to start with how ubiquitous AI is going to be in our world, in our lives, in the years ahead.
Well, to be honest, Denver, it's already quite ubiquitous. So many of the interactions we have today are mediated with AI. Most people, for example, are using a dating app. Guess what? Dating apps use algorithms and AI. Literally, who you might date and marry is being decided by algorithms. The kinds of jobs you get, how employers look at you, what kind of movies you watch, when you go out, what kind of experience you have. Many, many things in our lives are being subtly nudged, pushed, and shaped by artificial intelligence.
Mm-hmm. So listeners can better appreciate the lens that you look at all this through. Share with us a little bit about your background, which is somewhat different from a lot of the people working on AI in Silicon Valley. And I think that different perspective really is interesting in this burgeoning field.
So my background is as a quantitative social scientist, or as I like to say, I operate at the intersection of humanity and technology. I look at technology as a tool for human beings to use. My interest in things like data, algorithms, et cetera, came out of wanting to understand patterns of human behavior. So my PhD is in political science. I've also studied political theory, and my master's is in stats. So I look at the algorithms, but really the important part for me is these algorithms as a tool to understand the direction that people are going in.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting blend. I am the most casual observer of AI that you'll ever find. But I got to tell you, I always get a little disturbed by the language around it. And so much of what I see is this competition between the U.S. and China. Who's winning? Who's going to control the future? Who's going to control the 21st century? It sounds a lot like the arms race we had with the Soviet Union during the Cold War. Do you find that to be the case? And how do you feel about that?
What I worry about is us falling back into traditional paradigms of competitive languaging.
Mm.
There was an article in The Economist entitled The New AI Arms Race, and it was about the U.S. and China. And the field isn't meant necessarily to be economies versus economies and people versus people. In fact, one of the greatest things about the tech industry is that I can hire researchers or data scientists in India, in the Ukraine, in Bangladesh. People can get upskilled by going online to a website where they can learn stuff for free. Inherent in technology is globalization and decentralization, and yet we're shoving it back into these aggressive, combative paradigms, frankly, because I think we have no other way of thinking about these things often.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Talking about thinking about these things, you have coined a simply wonderful term called moral outsourcing. What do you mean by moral outsourcing?
This touches on what I was just talking about. When we talk about artificial intelligence, we don't use the same words that we use when we talk about other technologies. So you'll see articles like, this was a racist AI or a sexist algorithm. And it's very interesting because you would never refer to your car that way or your toaster that way. It'd be rather ridiculous. But we've taken this thing, artificial intelligence, which is literally, I can promise you, it's code, it's programming, it's built by a human being. And we've humanized, we've anthropomorphized it.
Yeah.
And then when something goes wrong, we shift the blame from the human that's created it, and we put that blame on the algorithm. So we're taking the morality, the responsibility of what happens in the outcome, and we've outsourced it. We've shifted it to the algorithm. So we're saying it's not my job. You know, I didn't know this bad thing would happen. I'm just an engineer, which is actually language we hear. I didn't know that would happen. I'm just an engineer. Well, we have a responsibility for the products we build. There is no other field or industry where the people would say something like, not my fault, the car hit you, right? Which is, you know, if you think about self-driving cars, that is the kind of language people might be using. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But so it's literally semantics. It's how we're using the adjective to modify the noun is totally different than we talk about any other technology.
Yeah, well, as we sort of said at the beginning, human beings have to control this. And we do talk about AI, if it's that it's a power or a force onto itself that is just out there and it's going to do all these things, either good or bad, but we don't have a say in all of it. Well, you work out in Silicon Valley, and that's a place that was envisioned to find solutions to the world's most vexing problems. Do you see companies thoughtfully thinking about AI along the lines you just mentioned, and taking into account ethical considerations when they're creating a product?
People are starting to. Unfortunately, I feel like Silicon Valley is behind many, many other parts of the world. I go to London quite a bit. London has one of the biggest scenes in ethics and AI, and it's a complete joy to be there because of the level of sophistication in conversations, et cetera, that I have. Most other parts of the world, it's not just in London, most other European countries I go to, Brussels, et cetera, because of GDPR, people are talking about privacy, security, ethics, things like that. In Silicon Valley, the conversation's a little bit different. So we have things like the time well spent movement, which talks about addiction to apps and products that are being built, et cetera, but very little yet about formal solutions on ethics and AI.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you mentioned a few moments ago, so much of our lives are being governed by algorithms right now. Our credit score, whether we get a mortgage, whether we get offered a job, as you said, whether you get the date you want or not. But these algorithms just might be a little less than perfect. There could be some problems. I know Accenture has come up with a new fairness tool to help address this. So give us some detail about these kinds of problems and what you hope this fairness tool might be able to do.
So what I love about the fairness tool is that it's a combination of, in my opinion, all the things that I'm interested in, all the things that I've studied. So the first question we asked is, what is fairness? What does it mean to be fair? And that is a deeply philosophical question that goes back to Aristotle.
Yeah.
When he wants to understand things like human flourishing,
societal fairness. I was looking at it the other day. There were 21 definitions for fairness.
Well, and that was just what that speaker had pulled together. He's a professor at Princeton. He did this really great talk, this conference on 21 definitions of fairness. Inspired by his talk, I emailed and asked for his class syllabus. So we sent over all these papers. I did a week-long something called a data study group with the Turing Institute, the Alan Turing Institute in London, and we came up with the early stages of this tool. And what this tool does is looks at both your data and your algorithm to determine whether or not the outcome is fair. So back to this definition of fairness. What I realized, a lot of our talk about bias and algorithms is actually incorrect. I think human beings, we understand that things screw up sometimes, right? Trains break down like mine did this morning. people make wrong decisions, etc. What we're not okay with is if the outcome is systematically more wrong for some people than it is for others.
Mm-hmm.
So what our tool does is it creates predictive parity. In other words, it's equalized outcomes. And if anyone listening is a lawyer, this idea of disparate impact is actually quite built into the legal framework. And you can say disparate impact means I've built something and it affects one group of people, let's say African-American men, different than it affects another group of people, let's say white men.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's something like a protected class, like race, that is actually illegal or unfair or just something we consider to be wrong.
When you make an algorithm more fair, is there a trade-off? Do you also maybe make it a little bit less accurate?
That might happen. And without sort of boring people with massive amounts of statistical mumbo jumbo, what I'll say is there are many ways to measure how good your algorithmic output is. And accuracy seems like, oh, accurate, great, right? But that is not the only way to look at your model. So what I can say, so an example I can give is, let's say a model, you say that my model outcome is 95% accurate. And when I break it down by the different subgroups, we see that it is 98% accurate for white men and only 68% accurate for darker skinned black women. Those are actually the numbers around most facial recognition algorithms. My good friend at MIT Media Lab, Joy Bellomini, that's her research. That's what she's found. But then can we actually say it's 95% accurate then?
Yeah.
It's problematic. And there are other ways that statisticians know how to look at our models and look at our output in ways that are more than just accurate. We look at things like goodness of fit, and there's all sorts of ways of thinking about your model and not just this number of how many things did I get right out of this testing set that I've pulled together.
Well, let's talk about a tangible example, predictive policing. Now, that seems to be an intelligent way for a police department to deploy its officers. What can be some of the potential flaws with that?
So, Denver, I'm going to give you a little sneak preview of the next thing I'm working on.
Okay.
It's something I call technological determinism. And inherent in how we build our algorithms, right? So how they are built. We have data. I build some sort of a model using that data. And then we have some sort of prediction that the model makes, right? Inherent in that is there is some sort of information in my past that can inform my future. And what I worry about, and that's fine for movie predictions and, you know, what kind of shirt you might want to buy or whatever, right? But when we start to talk about things like what jobs you should have, or, you know, again, the kind of things you might want to read, what I worry about is the most we'll ever achieve will only ever be a function of who we've been before. And that is such a problematic thing to think about. We think about our heroes in literature or in history, right? These are not people who just did what they were supposed to do. Our heroes are people who've defied the odds, who came from nothing. That is the American dream. That is the immigrant dream, to come from nothing and to make something of yourself. And here we are creating algorithms that limit what we see, the jobs we can get, literally where we can go, right? Who we talk to, how good we are, based on things like, you know, how much money did your father make?
Right.
And that's
the die is already cast.
Absolutely. So technological determinism from a technical standpoint are two things, something called a feedback loop and something else called measurement bias. So back to your question about predictive policing, that is a perfect example of technological determinism because it both has a feedback loop and measurement bias. So when you create a predictive policing model, so what I'm doing with this model is I take crime statistics, I build some sort of a model, and I say, I'm going to send out my police officers based on my prediction of where crime will be, based on where crime has been in the past. So, measurement bias. Crime, our measurement of crime, I'm doing air quotes here, does not actually measure true crime. It measures reported crime and number of arrests.
Exactly.
There are plenty of crimes that happen that are never picked up by our crime statistics. And that, back to this idea of, you know, bias being equal everywhere, that the likelihood of a crime being reported or not reported is not random. More affluent neighborhoods probably actually have lower reportings of petty crimes like drug deals, et cetera, right? And then you go do something like send the police officers to the places of where, quote unquote, higher crime exists. Guess what they do? They find and arrest more people. So then you create
the algorithm
feedback.
Works is what you say.
You create your feedback loop. You prove your own point.
You
say, that's a dangerous place. I send more cops. They arrest more people. Oh, look, I was at a dangerous place. So, you know, predictive policing is a perfect example of technological determinism. We are now isolating and identifying places we consider, quote unquote, bad. And this is based on not actually an accurate measure of where crime is happening. And frankly, it's informed by racist police practices, racist informing practices, all the things that are coming up today where people are reporting how there is massive discrimination against particular communities. And now we are algorithmically enforcing it.
Good explanation. Let's turn our attention to augmented humanity. Now, that's already here. We got bionic limbs and LASIK surgery and neurotechnology and CRISPR and gene editing. But boy, we are in the early, early innings. What are the next few innings going to look like? And what are the ethical concerns that we really need to be mindful of?
So we're at a critical juncture when it comes to things like augmented humanity right now, we're mostly at the stage where we take somebody who is disabled, et cetera, and we give them the ability to, let's say, have an arm again, see again, walk again. And there's a lot to unpack there in terms of ableism. There's this really great professor. Her name is Ashley Hsu. She does work on tech and ableism. But the next step where augmented humanity is headed is to take perfectly, you know, physically able people and augment ourselves. So now I could, let's say, run faster, or my parents could edit my genes in utero so I would be taller, or, you know, have a certain color eyes or hair or whatever. And interestingly, this is some of the conversation we had in the 90s when we talked about gene editing and designer babies, and that's actually where we are now. Mm-hmm. It took longer than expected. But my fear is that we're already born into an unfair world. And really, one might say that the one thing we all have in common is, you know, we live in these very fallible human bodies. But now what we're giving people the ability to do is even transcend that. And it would be simply a function of money. Yeah. How much money, contacts, and resources do you have? So, you know, and it's actually coming up a lot now when we talk about Stuyvesant and all these schools that use these tests to get in. And what some people have said is that it's a great way to get lower income students or people from families that couldn't afford, expensive school tuition to get a level playing field. But imagine your kid is now in a class with other kids who can afford, you know, brain implants, so that when they read, everything they read is memorized, and then it's just fed back into their brain.
Average is no longer good enough.
Average is the way you are born is now subpar because other people are getting bionic eyes and arms and limbs, etc. Or they're just, you know, genetically being modified to be, you know, extremely handsome or beautiful, which we know actually gives you a leg up in the world.
So how do you address this?
It's not something people are really talking about. And I understand why. It's still further out and there are very pressing, more immediate needs of algorithmic bias, et cetera. But I do think there needs to be regulation, a moment of reckoning, and actually thinking about this technology. And we can't wait for people to start doing it. Transhumanism is already a bit of a movement. Right now, it's frankly mostly sort of parlor tricks. I get an RFID chip in my hand and I can turn on my phone by waving it, you know.
Yeah.
But we're not that far away from getting to more real, viable things.
Right. And I think sort of at the heart of it, too, is the system of capitalism, you know, in terms of conscious capitalism and ethical capitalism. We really have to think about whether we can all move together with this or whether we are going to have an even greater discrepancy between the haves and have-nots.
Right. And this is a bit of a crisis of conscience that we see not just in tech, but even other industries. We had Larry Fink's famous letter that went out.
Yeah.
About this notion of capitalism or companies need to be about more than just making money. And I think a lot of people in Silicon Valley will agree. We just have massive amounts of wealth. Like, we get it. We made money. Congratulations. Now what?
Right. They're not the best winners in the world.
Right. You know, and I wonder what kind of – I think about this in San Francisco all the time. San Francisco is a Dickensian city. I live in an apartment where I pay $4,200 a month in rent to be in an 800-square-foot one-bedroom apartment, and I look out onto the street where people live in tents.
Yeah.
Is that the world I really want to live in? Do I really want to live in a Victorian-era city where I have to pay insane amounts of money, even though on paper I make an excellent salary?
A place as big as this studio.
Right. And I look out on the street and there is somebody who lives in a tent.
Yeah.
What kind of world have we built?
Yeah. I'll tell you about the world we built, and one thing that really blows me away, Ramon, is this social credit score that you see in China. Now, for listeners who are not familiar with that, explain what it is and what you think about it.
Well, a social credit score is kind of like the credit scores we have in the U.S., but it pulls in things like your family history, your level of education, your shopping behavior, your social media activity, your criminal record, and it creates a number for you. Essentially, it is that Black Mirror episode from season 2.
Yeah.
Where you have, Black Mirror episode is a little bit different because individuals could rate you. In this one, they can't directly rate every interaction, but it's pretty much an extension of that. So, you know, it's our credit score as we have it today, but hopped up on, you know, social media, your purchase behavior activity, et cetera.
If you jaywalk, they're catching you.
Yes.
Seen. Yeah.
And they're publicly shaming. So what they're doing is they use facial recognition to see if you jaywalk. They put you up on a Jumbotron screen with your name and, you know, a bit about who you are just to shame you for breaking the rules in jaywalking. I think most New Yorkers are cringing at that right now because I probably jaywalked seven times
on
the way
here. Wasn't it?
Yeah. How else would I get anywhere?
And the other thing that's really freaky about it, too, is there are consequences. Like, you can't travel or, I mean, you pay the piper if your score, you know, drops below a certain level.
And this is technological determinism, right? So you commit a crime and then it says, okay, well, because you've committed this crime, you now can't travel, you know, on these types of transit or to these locations or on this level, you know, on this class of a train or something like that, right? So we're limiting where people can go. But you think about it, what are we assuming here? We're assuming that someone who does a bad thing is inherently a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my problem with all of this. Just because one has committed a crime does not inherently make you a bad person. And so, but then we're codifying this in our algorithms. We're saying, oh, bad thing. Then you go into the bad person bucket.
Yeah.
But we limit your opportunities in life. So how are we allowing a quote unquote bad person to then improve themselves?
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, what we're doing is we're defining an individual by the worst thing they've ever done in their lives.
And right.
That's pretty sad.
Absolutely. And we see it on social media where people are sort of one extreme or the other. But one thing I hear quite a bit is that all of us have gotten better at curating how we act. We police our own behaviors on social media because we wonder who's watching.
You do a lot of things for Accenture, but one of the things you do for your clients is you get them to think about a culture of ethics in an organization. Because if you're working in a place, you really can't stop and think about ethical considerations too easily. If the leadership is saying, get the product out and get it out ASAP, what do you advise your clients? What questions do you have them ask themselves, and how do you guide them to think about this issue?
One really positive thing I'm seeing from a lot of Accenture clients is people are very, very interested in this culture of ethics. I don't have to sell too hard that, you know, I can build all the fairness tools in the world and help data scientists, et cetera, with products, but it wouldn't matter if we have no accountability and agency. So my 2018, 2019 goals for Accenture and what I'm building out is on the concepts of agency and accountability. How do I empower people to do the right thing? But also, how do I create a good chain of command? How can that idea of doing the right thing be a prominent business decision? How can we be proud of things like saying no to a contract because it was unethical? And that's the direction we need to head in. People will not unilaterally act that way. They will act that way if they're rewarded.
Mm-hmm. Sticking in the corporate world for a minute, you know, we think about all the ways AI is being used. Is it being used by human resource departments, human capital departments?
So one of the biggest ways AI is being used right now by a non-immediately tech audience is in hiring and human resources. So we have companies that judge video interviews by how enthusiastic your face looks and how well of a culture fit you might be. And I have a lot of questions about how that might work because I have a lot of questions about how that might go wrong. We have natural language processing being used to parse out resumes. And what I think about or worry about with that is, are we pushing people into these very traditional buckets of, oh, you went to a good school, therefore you'll be a good hire, when actually what we know about the future of work is it's no longer a function of what school you went to. Frankly, one would say it's never been a function of what school you went to, but about other characteristics. So we're using AI and human resources and a lot. And I understand exactly why. Companies are inundated with probably millions of resumes a day, some of them. There has to be some way to parse through. There's no good scientific, systematic way. But I wonder if the right sorts of ethical considerations are being put into place.
Mm-hmm. Well, you work with these companies, again, on internal governance around AI. And maybe one of the reasons you do it so intently is because the government hasn't done all that much, or have they? I mean, where do we stand with regulation and guidelines being put forth by the government?
Well, the good news is the government has finally started to look at AI more. And I know there's been a committee formed. I will say, though, that we are behind other governments. Macron came out with a really, really good strategy for France. The UK House of Lords, I actually sit on the advisory board for the parliamentary group at the UK House of Lords, and I've sat on some of the meetings. Really amazing conversation. They have a really wonderful report that it's called the APPG. The parliamentary group has come out with, this is after a year of having meetings, deliberations, et cetera, really comprehensive report. Obviously, we know China has a comprehensive national plan. Canada is investing a lot of money. I mean, we are a bit behind.
Mm-hmm.
just a bit.
just a bit. Let's switch over to the nonprofit sector, because, boy, those issues around ethics and AI are as important, probably even a little bit more important in the nonprofit sector. We're dealing with human beings all the time in terms of our clients. It's nowhere near as far along as the business sector. A couple shining lights like Crisis Text Line and Update.org. But what advice would you have for a nonprofit CEO as they begin to think about embedding AI into their organization and particularly into their programs?
I think this is an amazing time for nonprofits to shine in this space. So we were just talking earlier about this idea of conscious capitalism, et cetera. Well, the point of conscious capitalism is not the capitalism, it's the conscience part.
Yeah, that's why it comes first.
Right. And this is where I think nonprofits play a role. So rather than thinking about AI as just yet another tool you buy or yet another product you integrate, think of it as a dialogue that you need to participate in. And as companies, as I mentioned, companies are quite interested in understanding ethical culture, ethical behavior, et cetera. But frankly, what I hear the most is, I don't really know how to do this.
Mm-hmm.
How am I supposed to know if some community is being marginalized or impacted? I've never had to think about these things. This is where activist groups, nonprofits, et cetera, play a very, very strong role because they have been doing this stuff for a very long time. And there's so much to be learned across the board. One of the projects I'm working on, I represent Accenture at the Partnership on AI, and one of our working groups is about fairness, accountability, and transparency.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on a project called Diverse Voices, which is built on a project that already exists, but it's about augmenting the voices that these groups, for example, Amnesty International, NAACP, et cetera, have in influencing the dialogue on AI with corporations. So it's not about just create some advisory board, pull them together once a quarter, then pat yourselves on the back for no longer being racist.
Yeah.
It's actually about sparking a useful dialogue where both people are learning.
Yeah, that's right. Because I would imagine a lot of people in Silicon Valley kind of come from the same background and don't have the empathy that you would have from some of these groups or the disabled or older people. They all come from their own perspective.
There is way too much cultural homogeneity in Silicon Valley. I am an anomaly because I'm a social scientist. So that will tell you what little diversity there is in our cultures. I mean, and frankly, most of us, we were born in a very particular way. A lot of us are, come from middle class households. Most of us are, as I call it, culturally American, even if we're not ethnically white.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder and harder to find people from varied backgrounds, varied income levels, varied levels of representation. And what's sad is Oakland is a city full of really, really wonderful programmers, data scientists, et cetera, who were just never brought into Silicon Valley. I mean, I think some of the numbers that have been released are abysmal.
Yeah.
2%, 3% of the entire workforce being black or Latino is incredibly problematic.
No question about it. Let me close with this, Ramon. Speaking directly to our listeners out there, someone who's not involved in the field, but a person for whom AI, as we discussed, is becoming a bigger part of their lives every single day, what words of caution, what words of wisdom would you leave them with?
The individual person has control over the outcomes that are coming in the next few years. We're not meant to take a back seat and just let the world happen. And it may seem like it. There are these massive multi-billion-dollar companies that are seemingly controlling our lives. But our actions we take, we have smartphones, we watch Netflix, we do all of these things where we engage with the technology. We need to demand more. We need to demand better. We need to ask questions. And when we do so, that's when people will be better. That's when companies will be better.
Well, Ramon Trodbury, the global lead for responsible AI at Accenture, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Despite all we talked about, we've only really scratched the surface of the issues that you address. Where can people learn more about your work?
Well, you can visit my website. It's just my name, www.ramonchowdhury.com. You can check out my Twitter, all of it, LinkedIn, et cetera. It's all linked from my website.
Well, thanks, Ramon. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Tiana was homeless and looking for a change. At Year Up, she gained valuable skills and a path to success. 85% of Year Up alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support transformative opportunities for young adults like Tiana. Visit yearup.org. Most teachers spend more than $500 of their own money on school supplies each year. That's because too many classrooms lack books, microscopes, art supplies, and even pencils. At DonorsChoose.org, you can help students and teachers get the resources they need for a successful education. Whether you support a field trip to a local museum, yoga mats for a health class, or technology to teach kids to code, you can join the 2 million individuals who've already made a difference in the classroom. Visit DonorsChoose.org to bring a classroom dream to life. If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
Have you ever found yourself in an environment or setting well beyond what you would ever imagine for yourself? One that was meant for other people, but certainly not you. But once there, something strange happened. Through the value you provide and your interactions with others, you come to realize that, in fact, you do belong here or at another place just like it. That is very much what happens to the students who are part of the Genesis Works program. And here to tell us about it and the difference it has made in so many young lives is the founder and CEO of Genesis Works, Rafael Alvarez. Good evening, Rafael, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Thank you very much, Denver.
Let me start by asking you, Rafael, what is the central problem that Genesis Works addresses?
You know, at the very center, there's two realities. One is that companies need people, right? They need people to carry on their business, and they're having a hard time finding that stream of people. On the other hand, there's a whole segment of the population that are great young men and women that are growing up in underprivileged communities, not knowing what their true potential is, and following the path that their families have always taken. And yet, if they only had that opportunity to experience that they can succeed in this new setting, to realize that it's not that hard, it's not this big, ugly world, that changes their mindset, that changes their framework. And when those two come together, now you equip young people to provide those services that companies want, and that's how you accomplish change.
Fantastic. So you were working on corporate strategy for Compaq Computer. We all remember Compaq Computer. How did the idea for what was to become Genesis Works take root?
Yeah, so I was a corporate strategist working for this big company, served on the boards of nonprofits like, you know, many successful professionals do. Mm-hmm. And I went to a graduation ceremony one evening. Saw these students in this charter school that I served on the board for graduate and be very happy about graduating. Most were first in their family to graduate from high school. So this was an accomplishment. Yeah. They were very happy. So I went down to the floor to congratulate them, shake their hand. And as I did that, I asked them, so what are you going to do in your life now? And like, well, I'm just going to continue my job. And I thought, okay, what do you do? And what I found out was that they were pursuing just minimum wage, dead-end occupations, mm-hmm. which are good, honest jobs
sure.
for when you're in high school, but don't provide that path to the income that you need in order to live in the economic mainstream and to truly realize your potential, right? And so as I thought about it and found out that it's because they never saw themselves in the corporate world. And that's when the idea occurred to me. I thought, yeah, if, you know, I worked in Compaq, I knew that there were things that we were doing for our corporate clients that were not that hard to do. And I knew how much money we were charging for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought if I could train these students to provide those services, in essence, we could become like the disruptive technology in the services business, in the IT segment, and get these students to experience success in that corporate world during their senior year in high school. And through that experience, A, provide a valuable service to a company, but also help the student realize that there is a different path. And I thought, well, if that was to happen, how would that experience change the mindset of the students and the actions, the decisions that they make
mm-hmm.
as a result of that? How can this be that fork in the road, this catalyst that changes the trajectory of life for the students that we serve? And so the interesting thing about this is that I had that thought the summer of 2001. And what happened September 11 of that year?
Yeah.
Of course, we all know what happened. And I sat there and I thought, okay, that could be me mm-hmm. in the Twin Towers, right? It could be me that died. And if I died tomorrow, which I could, what have I accomplished with my life? What impact have I had And if I was honest with myself, the answer was not pretty. Right? I had created a lot of PowerPoint presentations and, you know, perhaps, you know, made some money for the company. But I had never changed the lives of people. And so at 33 years old, I decided, hey, a week after September 11, I decided to quit my corporate job and start Genesis Works.
Unbelievable. It's interesting how a confluence of things like that come along and really change the trajectory of your life as well. Well, tell us a little bit about the program of Genesis Works. I mean, how long does it go, and what does it entail?
Yeah, so we start recruiting juniors in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And our sweet spot is what we call the quiet middle. That middle-of-the-pack kid in large urban schools serving an underprivileged population. But we're not going after the super performer young man or woman or the troublemaker either. It's that middle-of-the-pack kid who normally is pretty quiet, has it in them to succeed. They just don't have the opportunity. And so we give them the opportunity. They come in for training over 8 weeks in the summer prior to their senior year in high school. But 80% of them make it through the training, and those are the students that we assign to an internship. So the students are our employees. They work for us. They're W-2 employees of ours.
Mm-hmm.
We assign them to our clients, and that's where the students work for an entire senior year in high school. They go to school in the morning in their regular schools, and then they'll work about 4 hours a day, 5 days a week during the senior year. And then through that year, they get to discover not only they can succeed as technical professionals or accounting professionals, but they also get to explore different avenues and careers and universities with which they can continue their career.
Yeah, you provide that college and career counseling for them, don't you?
Absolutely. So our students are coming from schools that the ratio of counselor to student may be 500-1. And honestly, counselors don't even know their names. But we have a ratio of 20-1 where the students come in and this program coordinator that we call, their only job is to make sure that these 20 students get to the finish line and have the right realization of their true capabilities and opportunities to pursue.
Yeah, it's interesting. It certainly doesn't mirror it, but there are certain elements of this program that are like your own experience that you had in Mexico City, correct?
Yeah, a little bit. So when I was 16 years old, I was delivering computers for a little computer company. Now, this is before Compaq even, I guess Compaq was in the early stages, but it was early stage in the PC revolution. And so my job was to deliver computers, and through the process, I learned how to program. The language was BASIC, remember?
Oh, I certainly do. I took it.
Yeah.
And can't remember a thing, but I took it.
And so I learned a few things in BASIC, and then I looked at the teachers teaching BASIC, and I thought, man, I could be teaching BASIC instead of driving around this crazy city of Mexico City. And my boss, Rodolfo, gave me a chance. He gave me a chance, a little senior in high school,
mm-hmm.
to teach programming instead of, you know, driving around. And that was the beginning of my career, because I leveraged that into my first internship in college, which was in my freshman year in college, and then my sophomore year, and then junior. By the time I finished college, I graduated in the middle of a recession, but it didn't matter. My experience was so strong
mm-hmm.
that I didn't have a problem.
Yeah, and these were big companies too, Procter & Gamble, Chrysler, places like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Give us a picture of your student profile.
So our student profile is what we call the quiet middle.
Mm-hmm.
These are good young men and women. You know, they want to work hard. They want to follow direction. They're hungry for knowledge and opportunity. And that is what they don't have much, you know, opportunity. And so they come into a program, they recognize the opportunity that we're making available for them. And once they start their internship in the company, they work so hard and so well. And they're the kind of young person that, you know, corporate professionals just want to have under their wing.
What happens to them when they go to that company? I'd always be interested in terms of the transition that or the transformation that occurs. I mean, here they're still in high school. They're working one of those companies that's in the skyline in many cases that they've only looked at from a distance. They're having expectations placed upon them. They're meeting those expectations. They're exceeding those expectations. And they're providing some real value to the company. How does that change the individual?
Well, let me ask you, Denver, because I'm sure it happened to you as well. I'm sure along your trajectory, somebody gave you opportunities to do things that you didn't quite think were possible, right? You mentioned that in your introduction.
Yeah, I would have to say, you know what happened to me was that I used to work at the United Way. It was my first job. And I was exposed to a lot of CEOs because back in that day, CEOs were very heavily involved in the United Way. And I would go out and with calls on them, and I'd recognize they were just regular people. Yeah. I always had this picture of them as being these supermen or superwomen, mostly supermen. And it turned out they really weren't. And you said, you know, they're not that much different than I am.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me. I was touring one of our locations in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area, and one of the students asked me, what's it like to be a CEO? And my answer was pretty immediate, and I said, I'm always scared. And that caught him by surprise. And like, explain. And I said, you know, as a CEO of a national nonprofit organization, my job is to constantly push the envelope, constantly push to the next level. And as individuals, you know, we have to be doing that in whatever it is that we're doing, right? And so when we go to that next step, we're scared. It always feels scary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were talking earlier before the show started about I love to snow ski. Well, what I tell myself is that if I'm not wiping out every now and then on snow ski, I'm not skiing at the edge of my ability. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not doing that, I'm not getting better.
Right.
And if I'm not getting better, what's the point? And so it's the same thing in your career. It's, you know, always pushing yourself. And so when this happens along a career, you start to recognize being afraid. Mm-hmm. You start to recognize that feeling that at the end, it's going to be okay. At the end, you're going to learn that you could succeed and that what once felt scary no longer is. The problem is with our students in underprivileged populations, actually students everywhere, we're not giving them that opportunity to stretch, to develop that muscle of fear, right? And I think that that is probably the most important thing that we do at Genesis Works, is we allow students to experience something that, A, they wouldn't have been able to get without us, you know, but second, that exercises that fear muscle.
Oh, sure, absolutely. If you don't feel that discomfort, you're not going to grow. And I know the kind of fear you're talking about. It's the healthy fear. It's not the paralyzing fear, but it's the fear that gets that adrenaline really going.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of breaking through, one of the things you have is a breaking through ceremony that occurs in the fall. Tell us what happens at that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful ceremony where students dress up and they come with their parents and our corporate clients are there and our philanthropic partners are there. And we do it in the fall when they're beginning their internship, not at the end, like a graduation ceremony. It's at the beginning. Why? We want to expose the student and we want to place them in front of their families and have their families start to view their young, you know, son and daughter as a professional.
Yeah.
Right? So when they're dressed up in their suits, for many, this is the first time they've ever worn a suit, and we do it in a big stage, and we recognize the companies, the places where they're working, you know, I think it really changes the mindsets of students and families. And we call it breaking through because that's where we celebrate students breaking through their barriers.
Because
they all have them. We all have barriers.
Yeah, sure.
You know, breaking through their barriers, their fear, right, into a professional career.
And one of the coolest things you do is you give them a box of business cards, right?
You know, it's funny. I was having lunch at one point with a lobbyist, an education lobbyist, who was claiming, you know, just give us more money and we can fix education. And I'm not going to say his name, but I said, not necessarily. I go, do you know what we do with $10? He said, you can't do anything with $10. And I pull out my business card and I say, we give a box of business card to our students, to each one of our students. And they have their name and their information and everything. And I said, this is 100 opportunities for the student to feel like a professional. And I think that's what's missing in our education. We're not allowing our young men and women to feel successful and to the level of potential that they can really, really have. And so it's about thinking differently.
Yeah.
About how we treat our young men and women and the opportunities that we put in front of them.
Yeah, we all know the magic of a business card. You just feel like a different person. You're a data-driven organization, and you measure everything, including the social return on investment. Share with us, Raphael, some of those numbers.
So a couple of years ago, a study by Columbia University was conducted on the social return on investment. And what they did was looked at how much more likely each one of our students was of finishing college education. And as a result of that, what was their expected increase in earnings, in income over their lifetime. And they concluded that it was like 13 and a half times, right? So they were very happy about that. People were happy about that. But then when I dug into the study, I thought, okay, but you're not even taking into account the students that go to college and don't succeed all the way through college. But as a result of their work, their resume that they now have as a result of the experience, they were able to get a job that actually paid a lot more. And we actually confirmed this over our comprehensive alumni survey studies, that even those students that don't finish a college education are much better off in life because they now had that opportunity to start in this IT career as a technical professional, right? And so that study's 13.5%. I mean, 13.5 times the return. But I believe that the reality is actually better than that.
Yeah, that's lowballing it. What are some of those other numbers? I mean, how many of your students go on to college? How many complete? And what do they make? How much? What's their medium pay, let's say, 5 years out?
So about 95% of our students, when they finish the program, they go on to college.
95%?
95%.
That's
because
impressive.
Through their year, we're actually working with them to explore what colleges are right for them, what careers are right for them. So 95% go on to college. Of those that pursue a four-year education, 65% of them actually succeed in getting their education. It takes them longer, 6-7 years, because what we found out is that 92% actually work during college. They have to.
But even that number, I think, is better than the national average.
It is.
Yeah.
65% is good. I still worry about the other 35%. And the question is then, you know, how can we even improve on this work experience that through work, whether you graduate from college or not, you can actually achieve a level of financial sustainability for your family, right? So for the students who are finishing college, no question they're going to do much, much better. I mean, literature is clear on that. But we want every one of our graduates to join the economic mainstream because that's what we're about.
You started this program, as you mentioned, back in 2002 with 10 students. Wasn't easy. Then 20. Now you've scaled up to about 4,000 or so in different places across the country. Boy, we know one of the most difficult challenges for either a profit or nonprofit is to scale up an organization. What can you share about successfully scaling one up?
You know, scaling in the nonprofit sector is really hard.
It
and
really
the reason is access to capital. Once we have a site up and running, about 80% of our total budget comes from earned income.
Yeah.
This is the money that we charge companies for the services that students provide. And companies are happy to pay that because they're getting value from the students, right?
And I think about 95% of them re-up, right?
They do. They do year over year, right? This is no longer about charity. Yeah. This is about solving their business needs with a solution that actually also changes the trajectory of life of young people. But we still need to raise a growth capital money every time we want to grow. Growth is expensive. And when we start a new city, it's almost all philanthropic money, right? Or even when a city is established, 20% of a few million dollars is still a good chunk of change. And you know, and access to philanthropy is, you know, it's not as much as the capital markets. When you have a great for-profit intervention that proves its model and becomes profitable, then access to capital is almost unlimited. In the nonprofit sector, it's not quite so. And so that's why it's much, much harder to scale in the nonprofit sector.
Well, speaking of scaling, you made some significant news recently with your announcement that Genesis Works is expanding its program right here to New York City. Give us some of the details of that.
Oh, we're so excited about Genesis Works coming to New York City. There is so much opportunity here. There's so much opportunity to connect young people with corporations. I mean, there's so much of everything here in New York City that we are so excited to start an office here and start serving young people and corporations here in the city.
Yeah. And one of your big partners in this is going to be AT&T here in New York. But tell us a little bit more about your corporate partners, who some of them are and what the relationship you have with them, how that those numbers all work.
You know, I think long gone are the days where corporations had to choose between doing what's good for the company, for the bottom line, or doing what's good for the community.
Mm-hmm.
More and more companies are realizing that you can actually do both, right? And AT&T is a great example of that. You know, we've had a multi-year relationship with AT&T where our students have proven to be valuable in their business. And AT&T has been a major, major supporter of our work as we scaled and grew into the Bay Area and now New York City and other markets. AT&T's philanthropic funding has been behind a lot of that growth. We also have other great clients like Salesforce.com and JPMorgan Chase and Accenture. that have all realized the value of our this double win-win, if you will,
yeah,
and are embracing that.
Some real blue chippers, that's for sure. I know, Raphael, that you are exceptionally proud of your corporate culture. What are some of the elements that make it special, and what are some of the things that you intentionally do to guide it and shape it?
You know, this millennial generation that is here now is there's a lot of great things about it. And one of them is young people want to have a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
They want a career, for sure, but they also want a purpose. Right? So we are very, very lucky to have young men and women coming into Genesis Works, working hard, working really, really hard, putting all their heart into it, and creating change for the young men and women that we serve. And so working at Genesis Works is not easy, I got to tell you that. You know, people frequently ask me, what do you do on a full-time basis? They ask me, like, you don't understand that we're a company of 1,000 employees with all the complexity that you expect that to have. And it's not easy, right? Changing lives is not easy.
No.
But we have a culture where people come in and just hit it hard. We're aligning what we want to achieve and succeed together.
Mm-hmm. You announced recently that you'll be stepping aside as the CEO of the organization you founded. I think that's going to happen in the first quarter of next year. What were some of the things that went into making that decision?
You know, very, very, very few people are able to translate the skills that they needed in order to start an organization, be an entrepreneur, to those skills that are needed to scale mm-hmm. an organization. I believe in the future and the potential of Genesis Works to truly scale to the magnitude of the problem. But I recognize that I'm an entrepreneur.
Mm.
You know, my skill set is that of being an entrepreneur and creating things from nothing, right? Now we're at a point where we need to bring in the person frankly, Denver, I wish had been my boss all these years, right? A person that is much more qualified, can engage in partnerships at a much higher level than I was able to do. And I'm excited to bring that person in. We are in the middle of the search right now.
Yeah.
We want to find the right person. But I feel proud of the team that we put together and what the team has accomplished right now. And then now it's time for me to go start on another thing,
mm-hmm.
right? And bring in the person that's going to take Genesis Works to that next level.
Because that's where your core competency is, starting something. So let me ask you this, and maybe you haven't thought about it, maybe you have, but it can be difficult for the person who comes in and follows in the footsteps of a founder. What can a founder do to help make that transition easier?
You know, people ask me sometimes, Denver, why am I so bent on growth? And the way I respond is, if you believe that what we do changes lives, it's my job to grow the organization as far as I can, up into the point that we're no longer needed, right? Mm-hmm. And we're far away from that. It's the same thing when it comes to CEO succession. My role is to support the new person in whatever way I can and get out of the way.
Mm-hmm. You know,
they're going to bring new ideas. We hire them because they have that greater mindset and greater level of skills. And I need to immediately get onto the background, have the spotlight be on that person. You know, I will always be the founder. I will always be there to support him or her. But I need to get out of the way and let them lead.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's my role.
I think that's good advice. Let me close with this, Raphael. You have been all around the educational system for the last 15 years or more, and despite the enormous success and growth that Genesis Works has had, the problem is so much bigger than that. If you were king for a day and could do anything you wanted to improve the educational system of this country, what would that be?
Denver, we've proven through our model that when you connect a student to an opportunity in the workplace, it's good for both. It's good for the student, it's good for the supervisors at the corporate place that are giving them this opportunity. Our problem is not the value that we're providing. The problem is awareness.
Mm.
So if I was king for a day, I would make sure that every professional in this country is aware that there is a way for them to provide opportunity to a young person, and that in doing so, they can benefit as well. And then creating that holistic partnership between every student in America for them to be able to truly experience a career that they never thought they could aspire to and connect every single professional to the youth in our country, then think about what that would mean for our future.
It'd be huge. Well, Rafael Alvarez, the president and CEO of Genesis Works, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us a little bit about your website, the information on it, and how people can help support the organization if they're so inclined.
Sure. The website is genesisworks.org, and I'll spell that for you. That's GENESYSWORKS.org. And there's multiple ways to support us. If you are a corporate client, particularly in the cities that we are in now or we're going to, you can go to our corporate section on our website, and there will be a contact information page there. And that's how you can become a corporate partner of ours. Or if you want to provide philanthropic support so that we can continue to serve even more students in the future, there is a button in multiple places in our website where people can actually donate.
That's good to hear. Well, thanks, Rafael. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, Denver.
And that is this week's show. Next week's guest will be me. That's right. The tables have been turned. I'm writing a book on workplace culture at nonprofit organizations entitled Better Than Most. Invigorate your corporate culture today with the secrets of exceptional nonprofit organizations. And I'll be speaking about that with Kyle Peterson, the president of the Walton Foundation. It will be very strange indeed sitting in that other chair. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And I hope you return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.